Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhuttaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
This the 100th day since Sister Upala died last February, when I was in Thailand, and the custom in Thailand is to have a memorial service 100 days, 50th day and 100 days. So I don't think we did one 50th for her, but 100. And it's, of course, 100 days have passed since she died, and this, and people have varying degrees of feelings or memories or emotional reactions to this perception. When somebody dies, we can, if they're close to us and if we love them and we have a lot of strong relationship with them, then of course the actual death leaves a kind of gap in the mind. It's something that takes time to get over. The grieving process or the experience of loss is something that I think people try to ignore in the Western world or suppress. Whereas in as terms of Dhamma, it's something to reflect upon. It feels this way, the loss of the loved ones. Notice that the Buddha's teachings are always encouraging this looking at the way it is, what you're actually feeling, not telling you how you should feel or how you should react when somebody dies, but encouraging you to admit and to notice what you're actually feeling. Sometimes in Buddhism we think if we're really mindful we won't feel anything. If somebody dies and we're really mindful and we've really attained stream entry or some state, then we wouldn't be, when our mother dies and we don't feel anything. We just say, oh, impermanent, all conditions rise and pass away in a kind of way that, you know, is without really, which is not the way it is. When somebody dies, it feels this way, whatever way you're feeling. And mindfulness then is to know that, to know the feeling of loss, separation from the loved, having to be with the unloved. All of this is noticing, watching, listening to the way it is, rather than taking positions on how you should be or how life should be. Interesting, Buddha Grove, where Declan, his ashes have been scattered, he was 1 year old, and Sister Upala was 91 years old. It's a 90-year, she lived 90 years longer than Declan. But it also, it's apparent that death is something that can happen at any time, when the first year or the 91st year. And Ruki's been doing a walking practice between Declan and Upala, because Ruki lost her mother. Mother died recently. It's been an important time for her to, and having such a kind of incredibly appropriate situation to to contemplate. this Drupa Lama was someone who the last years of her life was very much devoted to practice, and very, very sincere, earnest practicer, so that when she did die, she died literally in the arms of the Sangha, with them chanting. And I can't think of a nicer way to go. And that's how she wanted to go, and that's how she did, and she managed it somehow. I think they sent her off to the hospital in Hemel Hempstead, and they said, "Oh, she's just got a bug or something. Send her on back." And fortunately, otherwise she would have died in the Hemel Hempstead hospital, which wouldn't have been so nice. I was thinking maybe the kind of good powers of goodness in the world were down at Hemel Hempstead Hospital that day and kind of blinding the doctors to what was actually taking place. And it was just a bug, and send her on back. Death is something to, I mean, that in Buddhist meditation we approach very directly. It's a subject that needs to be understood and contemplated, and before our turn comes, we can see it as death is the gateway to the immortal. Death can be seen as merely the kind of the absolute end, or it can be seen in a perspective, its relationship to the immortal, the mortal to the immortal, the conditioned to the unconditioned. And this is a spiritual view, isn't it? When we're talking about a spiritual consciousness and developing that kind of wisdom and understanding, then we're relating death not as just absolute end, wham, that's it, forever, blank. As sometimes that's what it means to us. We think it's just, you know, oblivion, or it's just frightening, or it's the end of what we know, what we're used to, so it frightens us. And let's not think about it. Let's just ignore the whole thing. Let's pretend that life is just, we're going to live forever. Or, say, in terms of spiritual development, we see always the relationship of death to the deathless, mortal to immortality, a condition to the unconditioned. And this is very important. This is the liberating realization, is in that realization of the relationship. It's a relationship. It's not a. It's not something kind. It's not fixed. A kind of static. Perceptions. The condition is dynamic energy, isn't it? It's changing. Arising, ceasing, birth, being born and dying, and then the unconditional, the immortal. Is what. Say this arising, ceasing comes from. It's interesting though the word existence, because to exist, actual meaning to exist, means to spring forth or to come forth. So what exists for us is what comes forth. And so the conditioned realm exists for us. The mortal realm exists. But the immortal doesn't exist. It is. And so you can be a real radical Christian by saying God doesn't exist, and then they condemn you as being an atheist. When you're saying God isn't something that comes forth and dies, God is the immortal. So in the dualistic structure of thought, I mean, recognize that you're stuck. If that's all you're relying on is your ability to think, then one is caught in that kind of polarization of birth versus and death as one opposed to the other, and where things are polarized in a linear relationship, and so that the thinking mind tends to see things in black and white, good and bad, in absolute fixed perceptions. We tend to absolutize the perceptions that we have, and so we can easily see things in these kind of absolute terms. Absolute good, absolute right, absolute bad, absolute wrong. And this is where the problems and difficulties and wars arise in this human realm, isn't it? Because of that tendency to see something as bad, as kind of absolutely bad, all the time bad, or all the time good, absolutely forever good. We can see the people that don't agree with us as absolutely bad, and the people that agree with me as absolutely good. Or people that belong to my religious group, they're the good ones, and those that don't agree, don't go along with my particular religious conventions, are absolutely bad. The thinking process has that limitation. It tends to fix things because the thought itself, because we hold on and attach to perceptions and thoughts, then this grasping of thought, this grasping of perception fixes it, and we can carry it around and measure the flowing movement, dynamic quality of life with something that's fixed, that doesn't move in itself, that is due to our grasping of it. We take it and apply it even to situations where it doesn't belong. I mean, what conceit and arrogance and all this come from, cultural conceit and racial prejudice and all this comes from this fixity of the mind. To think that our race or our ethnic group or our civilization or our religion is the best or the superior one. And then to measure all other aspects of somebody else's group according to our fixed views. The superiority, say, of the white race, and the kind of Aryan white race arrogance that was, say, 50 years ago. Hitler was very much promoting the sense of the superiority of the white race. And yet he was obviously not a very superior being himself. it's the irony of it. If there's anything that makes you inferior, it's being attached to the idea that you're superior. Arrogance is not a quality of an enlightened and wise being, is it? It's a sign of an ignorant being, unenlightened being. The time now is where people are willing to contemplate death. And it's always kind of amused me to see when they give a death and dying weekend retreat here at Amaravati, it's usually booked up in advance with a waiting list. Why do people want to come and spend a weekend talking and contemplating death and dying. It's interesting, isn't it? And it's a good sign to me. It's not, because it shows that there's a kind of maturity taking place where people are beginning to ask those kind of questions. What's it all about? What is life? What is death? What is the purpose of it? What happens when we die? How should we take care of dying people? What is it all about anyway? These are questions that have needed to be asked long before now, but have been kind of dismissed, pushed aside for this sense of progress, development, everything's getting better and better. People even, you know, 30 years ago, I remember reading an article about some scientists thinking that eventually we could live forever through modern science, that we would never have to die. And he was very excited about this idea that with modern, all the kind of profundity and of modern science, that in a few years we would be able to discover how to prolong our lives forever. Which, you know, to me sounds dreadful. Imagine if we just kept, if we all lived forever and we kept breeding more, and they all lived forever. It'd be horrible. But obviously, he hadn't even thought to that, what would actually, the result of prolonging our lifespan for eternity. What that would be, you know, logically, what that would do. Can you imagine, you know, wanting to live in this form forever, the human form? And so in Buddhist meditation, we contemplate the nature of the body, because it isn't a very, it's quite remarkable in its own right, admittedly, as a condition. But as an experience, it can be pretty horrible, and it's filled with pain and kinds of unpleasant things that we have to deal with every day, just to maintain this physical body. So it's not too painful, not too unpleasant. So this, not to complain about it, but obviously, that the human body is not meant to be a kind of permanent abiding place for any of us. It seems quite an obvious truth that this human form is a temporary experience in time. And that's all. It's not to be attached to. It's not to be identified with. It doesn't matter how long you live. If you live 1,000 years, 91 years, 1 year. That's not really. It's how you live, isn't it? How wisely you learn from this experience. That's the important thing. Time is another convention that we regard as a kind of absolute reality. And just contemplating how that now, say, Sister Upala was, say, a year ago, we still, Sister Upala is here and now, living here at Amaravati. A year has passed, 16th of May, or 16th of May of 1992 and it's not 16th of May 1993, and Sister Upala is dead. The perception has changed. It's different, isn't it, when we think Sister Upala is here, she's over in Metasome, yes, she's not feeling well today or whatever. We think of her, we talk about her in the things, in the words and the perceptions that are familiar to us, isn't it, about the health, about whether she feels good or if she's happy or unhappy, or whether she's bright or dull, or if she's sleeping or awake, whatever. All these we understand. These are, we all know what these mean. But then when we say Sister Upala is dead, died in this 100 days ago, and we don't know quite what that, we haven't died, we're alive. So the mind reacts in a different way, doesn't it? If we think, oh, Sister Upala is, she's all right, she had a good meal and she's had a good night's sleep. She wants to offer a breakfast donna tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Oh, good. She always gave very fantastic breakfast donnas. But now we think, Sister Upala is dead. And then that's what does your mind do? Contemplate. Just the word dead, death, with the name of somebody you know. And so my mind, thinking mind stops. I don't know where she is right now. What's happened? I mean, we went out and put the ceremony around the grave, and the gravestone. They don't look very beautifully done way of remembering Sister Upala. Everybody kind of remembering her all at the same time. But we don't know. We can imagine underneath that ground is a coffin that Venerable Subhuto made. And inside that coffin lies a corpse that we would call Sister Upala. And we can't even see that. But maybe her vijnana or her soul is hovering around out there. Maybe she's smiling at us right now, looking at, from some kind of place in the consciousness of eternity. Sending us her blessings. We can talk, we can create perceptions like that. But those are perceptions we create in our mind. Or we can think, well, that's it, she died, that's the end. There's nothing left. And that's another perception. But the thing is, we don't know. And that's important to know that we don't know. To know what you know and what you can know and what you can't know is wisdom. So this is like reflecting, isn't it? We're noticing how things actually are, how life life is for us, what our mind does with it, what happens to us. We can watch it and we can listen, we can observe. We can reflect upon it. It's like this. For some people, and Sister Upala was a great joy, and people, when their name is mentioned, people have very, happy memories. Other people are may not have very happy memories. Other people may be just indifferent. But to know what it is, to know that what you're feeling is just that way, is being mindful, contemplating the way things are. As you break down the illusions of time, the past and the present and the future, then you realize the eternal now, and this is the pathway, this is the gate to the deathless, the eternal now. Because that's all there ever is now, as an experience. It's only now. And so the time conditions, you know, the bodies, the conditioned realm that we're experiencing is changing. And we perceive it in terms of time. The past it was like that. But then remember that the ability to perceive things and remember tends to petrify them, make them static. So when I think of Sister Upala 9 years ago, Beth Trigescus in an old people's home in Berkshire and inviting her to Amravati, and I can think, you know, that can be, I can get quite sentimental about it all. The thinking of that was somehow, that is the past, that's the reality of the past. But in reflection, you see, that's only a memory in the mind in the present, isn't it? That memory of inviting Beth Trigescus to come and live at Amravati 9 years ago is a memory in my mind. That's, I'm reflecting on the way it is, not on how one may like to think it is or believes it is, but as an actual wise reflection of what has happened, is it's that way. So the past is merely what we remember. It has no reality in itself. It's just the memory, the human individual human memory. You talk to you know, all of you probably don't have no memory of 9 years ago knowing Beth Trigescus. So you're just depending upon me, you know, to give you the kind of biography of Sister Upala. And we assume that it has a reality and a kind of a reality that it really is not there. We believe in it, we empower, we make it into something like a real history of a person through what people say. Ajahn Sumedho remembers Beth Trigescus 16 years ago when she used to come to the Hampstead Vihara in a taxi. She lived in a kind of old people's home in Shepherd's Bush and used to drop in every now and then, pay a taxi to bring her, and the taxi would wait and outside, and then she'd come in and ask all her Dharma questions, which she had written down. She's very kind of efficient in that way, and was very English, saying, "I don't want to be a nuisance and take up all your time." Get her business over and rush out. But that is a memory. Now it's important to put this perceptive ability in that perspective of merely what comes and goes in your mind, rather than making it into something more than that. Because that's where we really go off the track, when we cause all the problems and difficulties to ourselves and the world around us. Because we do believe our opinions and views and our perceptions of ourselves and others are, we believe in them. We attach to them and we believe in them. And then we create all kinds of misery for ourselves around it and misery for others. This is what's happening in Bosnia now. It's all based on that illusion, isn't it? People's minds believing that there are absolute Bosnian Muslims and absolutely fixed Bosnian Serbs and so forth. These people are, you know, if you're a Bosnian Serb, then you hate Bosnian Muslims, and that becomes the kind of attachment, the perception you're attached to. So whether anyone is a Bosnian Muslim or not doesn't make any difference. If you think they are, then you kill them, do something horrible to them. This is one of the most horrible examples of what happens in our minds. But it goes on and on and on in society. You hear it, you know, in the political problems of Britain, or all the fears, suspicions, racial prejudices, ethnic biases, religious prejudices, class prejudices, all the bitterness and resentment of the things that have been done against us or against our group or against our country from the past and so forth, and then we can get this emotion going inside us where we just want to strike out, lash out, get even, seek revenge, get rid of the bad ones, make them suffer like they made me suffer. This kind of emotional reaction is quite common. It's a low level, yes. It's low level, but it's certainly, I think we can all understand it. I think we've all felt it. I remember when someone has hurt me, I remember wanting to seek revenge. Fortunately, I'm not into seeking revenge. I'm not prone towards vindictiveness. I certainly felt it as an emotion. When we, and this in Vipassana meditation, where we take these five groups, and the Sanya Khanda, the perception Khanda, I found that because in the Western world we really believe in our views and opinions and in our feelings. We really believe it, that it's true. And so we do get very biased and blinded by our own kind of righteousness, self-righteousness. And then we become very heavy and very insensitive and say things and do things and to others, or we tend to suppress. We can also have, it always goes inward too, or hating ourselves, having very strong opinions about ourselves, which can be very unpleasant, very painful things that we're very much attached to. And when you examine it in terms of sanya, then you begin to see it. It's merely just a thing that comes up in the mind and comes and goes. It has no core, there's no essence. It's insubstantial. It has no heart. It has no soul. It's just what it is. And when you keep examining that, especially like do it with things that first are not too emotionally fraught for you. But while you can even take the people that you feel that arouse, say, anger or in your mind, when the memory of them, and you can begin to just see it in terms of a condition that arises and ceases in your mind. Because you're observing in the mind itself where things cease, the conditions that cease in the unconditioned, the mortal thing that takes you to immortality. Because if you keep that perspective of the relationship of the mortal to immortal and apply that just in very simple practical ways to your mind. Don't go around thinking your mind is immortal, then you're attached to another perception. Because we're not trying to hold on to a belief that we're immortal or our minds are immortal, but you're observing that the relationship of the conditioned or the mortal to the unconditioned, the immortal. And you can, and in mindfulness, say, in this ability to be mindful, is the gateway to immortality, to realization of immortality. And more that you contemplate this, then you let go, you release, you resolve the conditions of your life, your karma, in your mind. You're resolving it. You're letting it go. You're letting it cease. You're letting it die. What arises ceases. What is born dies. You're letting what is born, you're letting it die. So there's this mindful watching and listening. This is the attentiveness, ability to watch and listen, to be attentive and reflect, to use your thinking ability to reflect on what it is. So you know, you're given the clues by the Buddha, the conditioned, unconditioned, and the impermanent nature of the condition. You're definitely emphasizing that over and over. All that is subject to arising is subject to ceasing. Then he's talking about realizing the amata dhamma. And so that if you keep contemplating in this way, you break through the force of habit, the cultural conditioning, the underlying assumptions based on ignorance, and all the rest of it that tend to make you think otherwise, or believe in things to be other than what they really are, according to the way you've been conditioned to think or react, or what your culture or religion or parents or whatever have told you. You're getting outside just that kind of the cultural patterns through your own direct realization. And so in this form of a human being, you see, it's great, it's a form in which this can be done. This realization is possible within this human state. The human mind is a mind that can reflect on the way things are. We're not just a rational creature. We used to think that was the height of our humanity was our ability to think rationally, but that's not it. I mean, computers have taken over now. Went in to see Venerable Jitendra this morning, sitting at his desk with his computer. And says, "That's your brain on the desk." That's So to be rational, you just need a computer. There's nothing transcendent about it. And that's not the, even though that's pretty darn clever, admittedly. But in the long run, it's really nothing to take refuge in. Some people I hear take refuge in their computers. I don't, not ever knowing anything about them, I can't really say. But I would assume that it's not worth it. So the reflective, contemplative mind intuitive. You know, the intuition is always now, isn't it? The intuitive mind is now. It's not rational, it's not cultivated. It's always, it's a receptivity of the now. And that's all there ever is, intuition. If we trust in it, it's like what faith is all about, trusting. Not in trying to figure it out, because as soon as we leave the intuitive awareness into trying to figure it all out, we can get it all wrong through just by clumsily trying to perceive it in through the conditioning of our minds. And that's why it is so important to decondition the mind. In other words, it's a kind of meditation that's like brainwashing. It's washing your brain, cleaning your brain, deconditioning rather than conditioning. Usually brainwashing is a sign of conditioning, isn't it? Making you kind of believe in things that the person that wants you to, the tyrannical system that wants you to follow along blindly, they brainwash you. But in this, brainwashing is an actual cleansing, purifying. So you're deconditioning. You're not trying to become a Buddhist or become enlightened or become something. You're not trying to become. That's where these words like Sotapanna, Sakadagami, Anakami, Arahant, we have to be careful how we use those, because we tend to use those words out of our ignorant conditioned mind. So it's, I want to become a Sotapanna or become an Arahant and become enlightened. And that gives the wrong information. It's not what happens. That's not how it is. You don't become. You don't become enlightened or become an Arahant. That whole way of thinking needs to be relinquished, because that's not how it is. That tends to misrepresent it. So, in learning to think in a more precise way, we use the Dhamma teachings of the Buddha, not as kind of just memorize them and repeat them, you know, the kind of mechanical repetitions, but actually through our insights, using those teachings for reflection, we have the insights. So we realize there is suffering, but nobody's suffering. It sounds like paradoxes to us, doesn't it? There is enlightenment, but nobody ever gets enlightened. It sounds like, yeah, there is enlightenment, but nobody ever gets enlightened, and so nobody is enlightened. There is Arahant. There is Arahantship, but there's nobody that's an Arahant. Mm-hmm. And so then they say, well, maybe, you know, time of the Buddha there were Arahants, but now time is different. We're much more defiled, and we're not as pure as they were 2,500 years ago in India. The mind, we can explain it all like that. I've seen that even in Thailand. Monks would say there aren't any Arahants or Sotapannas anymore. Things like this. But they didn't mean it in the right way. They were just using it as an excuse not to have to bother to practice. So Ajahn Chah said, "Oh, you're a monk for a free meal. Is that what you're here for?" Too lazy to go to work, so you just want to scrounge off the people, get a free meal. There is dukkha, but it's not absolute. Notice that there is dukkha, but it's not saying there is dukkha as an absolute. It's a pointing, and there is dukkha. And then when we see the dukkha, say, the things we're attached to, the suffering that we're feeling, we see it in terms of there is this rather than I am this. And that's an important way to see it. It's important to see it because that's what it is. That's how it is. Maybe there is suffering because you're attached to things. There's attachment to things. But in reflective, intuitive awareness, then we see there's suffering. We're looking at it. We're understanding the suffering. We're not thinking I'm suffering. We're not going to operate from that perception, I'm suffering. Because if we do, then what happens? We think, I'm suffering, what did I do to deserve this? It's your fault that I'm suffering, or it's my fault because I'm such a horrible person and the world's not fair and God did it all wrong, and the whole realm of grumbling, complaining, depressing thoughts arise because I'm suffering and I don't want to suffer. What did I do to deserve this? Whereas, say, in reflective, intuitive awareness, is you're not trying to say life is wonderful and I'm happy or I don't suffer. There's no suffering, but there is. There's this feeling, this heat, this anguish, or this grief, or whatever. There it is, and we go to it. We accept it, we acknowledge it, we receive it. And through that receptivity, we resolve it. It ceases. The condition ceases in the unconditioned. The mortal dies in the deathless, in the immortal. And when you do that, then the result is non-suffering, is a peace. A peacefulness. And notice this, and just in you who are on this meditation retreat, notice when you're really letting things go in your mind, that sense of peace and calm, bliss, comes from that's non-attachment. And there's nobody at that moment. When you start becoming somebody, then it's gone. When you want it again, you want to have it, or you. Whatever, then you the desire and then the attachment and the process starts up again. You become somebody who wants to have happiness or bliss or peace and doesn't want to have maybe the confusion or annoyance or the unpleasantness of the suffering that you're feeling in the moment. So in reflective awareness we're noticing that, we're paying attention to that in its subtlety. Don't wait for a kind of a full-blown kind of thunderbolt, a brilliant thunderbolt to zap you, because we're working on a subtle level, in the middle way, or the transcendent, or the immanence of the here and now, which has no extremity to it. It's not absolutely fantastic or absolutely horrible. Bringing your attention to the way it is, just the body, the breath, the silence. This is where you keep grounding and centering yourself to bring yourself to keep remembering now. Because we are forgetful and we get carried away, the force of habit so strong to get carried away with things that we forget. So mindfulness is also memory, remembering. But you're remembering things in the right way. You're not just getting sentimental about it, remembering the good old days. or when Sister Upala used to come in a taxi to the Hampstead Vihara, getting sentimental and gooey about it. That's sentimental memory. But this is remembering the way things are, because we forgot. You get carried away with anger or greed or something, and then you forget. You're caught in this heedless reactiveness and confusion of the mind. So you remember. The refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha, we can make that into like a, to help us to remember. Those are perceptions, yes, just like any others, but they're tools for to use to remember. The Buddha is the awakened one. The Dhamma is the way things are. So I mean that relationship of knowing the way things are is the refuge. It's consciousness, isn't it? It's the pattern of consciousness, subject to object. And that's the way it is in this form, isn't it? Each one of us is the subject. And the rest is the object. I mean, we're born in an individual form like this, and so it's the actual experience through consciousness is a subject to object one, and that is reflected in the refuge of Buddha to Dhamma. Instead of me and the things that happen to me, it's changed from the translating in terms of me as a personality who and that things happen to this universal pattern is exemplified in Buddha knowing the Dhamma. So the Buddha is that pure knowing, awakeness, attentiveness of mind. When there's mindfulness, when there's awareness, that's Buddha. You don't become Buddha. To become Buddha, you've got to go back to your old way of thinking about I am not the Buddha and I will become one. But in terms of intuitive awareness, then the refuge in Buddha is not a sentimental refuge. It's not just a nice thing to be attached to as a pleasant idea in the mind. But it's the reality of being. Because in that awakeness, there's not a person. It's not a personality. It's not Ajahn Sumedho or anyone else. In that pure awareness, that's universal. That's Buddha nature. Or the Buddha mind. That's not an individual possession or characteristic. And then we see, then there's the seeing, the right seeing of Dhamma. The conditions as the what arises and ceases and the unconditioned. We realize the unconditioned. So note in this form we realize the relationship, the cessation of the conditioned and to the unconditioned. It's that relationship. You're not trying to realize the unconditioned and grasp that. Because in the form we're in, the path is through the realization of that dynamic relationship. The conditioned to the unconditioned, or the death to the deathless. And that we can do. And we do it not in a big way, in little ways. That's why we're looking inward rather than trying to see it in external things. Just the movements of our mind. And more you begin to feel a sense of being at ease in being aware. At first, we're not used to being aware continuously. You know, we're aware, you know, when things around us are danger, then you're suddenly aware. But then it's easy for us to just sink into a mood. Get up and then go to the morning chant, drag yourself off and just follow a mood. And then, I want to disrobe, I'm tired of monastic life. And you can get enlightened if you're a lay person. And you go along, you know, you can carry on for weeks, months. Some do it for years. Just following moods. And so that, you know, even monastic life, one can just go through the motions of it. It's not like a magic formula that transforms you into being mindful. But recognize in monasticism that the forms are here for develop mindfulness. The robes, the bowl, the chanting, the whole thing is here, not because it's anything of, you know, that it has to be, or you have to have it and be attached to it, or the other extreme is the kind of cheeky Zen approach where you don't need Buddha Rupas, you don't need monks or morality and all that, just mindfulness. And you can throw out the whole lot, the whole convention of religious conventions, spit on the Buddha. And that's another, that's not being mindful either. So that the way then is like see the say monastic conventions are to remember, and it's up to us to use them. They are what they are. So I mean, they can't do it themselves. Remember, they're nothing in themselves. They're just conditions like anything else. They can't kind of. Your robes can't go around saying, "Wake up, tomato." But I can start waking up to my robes, contemplating the robe, the bowl, the meaning of the chanting, the contemplating the teachings of the Buddha, developing the concentration practice. And going through all this in a way of using attentive awareness and wisdom, so that more and more my life has more continuity, more integrated awareness through the right use of these conventions. Remember, the world has a certain power, screaming urgency to it. The world screams. Desire it can be really intimidating and overwhelming in how it manifests. But there's always something, no matter how. What it is, there's always something in you that can be aware of it. Trust in that kind of distance, that ability to just observe it, realize it, that it's just that. No matter how urgent or important the worldly conventions might be proclaiming themselves, and maybe they really are. Maybe, you know, it's not to say that worldly conventions aren't important or urgent, but it's the ability to be aware of them and put them in the perspective rather of in their relationship in, as Dhamma, rather than to be just caught in the reactiveness. The way we can just react to the urgent sound of the world. And that means that we're just on automatic pilot, isn't it? We're just a computerized creature, just a kind of dead computer, kind of mechanical creature that's programmed to react. The world says, it's important, it's important. we're programmed like the computer, so that we're just on that level of just being a condition that just follows its reaction that conditioned to react, programmed to react to various things in various ways. Then to be free from that is to be aware of it. Doesn't mean we don't feel it. We don't experience it anymore, but we start paying attention to it. So note that the Buddha is the knowing, the attentive, the aware, the intelligent. And out of that is, you say, the relationships then to the world are compassionate ones. Loving ones. It's not a cold-hearted Buddha that says all conditions are impermanent, suffering and not self, and dismisses the all the conditioned world, is it? That's not it. That's your rational mind. That's not intuition. But as you abide more in that intuitive awareness, then you relate your relationships, how you live in relation to the world, to the people, to the beings, is through the metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, the Brahma Viharas. Because that's from the pure, they're called the pure abode, that's from the pure mind of the Buddha. It's not a cold-hearted, chilly Buddha that says, doesn't matter, it's all impermanent, suffering and not self. Goodbye. Goodbye, cruel world. I've dismissed you. Or, Sister Upal has died, all things that arise cease. Stiff upper lip. If you're really mindful, you won't cry. And attached to the opinions you grasp out of some of our spurious interpretations of Buddha, of the Pali scriptures. So I offer this for your reflection.